Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio AM in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the first day of December 2018. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. As human beings, mental health is important to all of us. Some of us enjoy pretty good mental health for most of our lives, but we all experience imbalances from time to time. For some, it's worse. Anxiety, depression, emotional instability, and mental illness are central to many lives, and that, of course, has effects on the lives of those around them. Mark Germain is a good friend of mine, and he's heard here on Talk Radio 1 .com most Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. A few weeks ago, Mark sent me a link to an interview with a fascinating psychologist who discussed the difference between a narcissist, a psychopath, and a sociopath. I found it compelling, and so it is my pleasure to welcome that clinical psychologist to the show. Dr. Ramani Dhruvasula, welcome to TalkRadio1.com.
Thank you, Stephen. It's so nice to be on with you.
Thank you. What is the difference between a narcissist, a psychopath, and a sociopath?
Short answer, all psychopaths and all sociopaths are narcissistic, but not all narcissists are psychopathic and sociopathic. The big difference is remorse. People who are narcissistic can actually feel a little bit guilty or shameful about doing bad things. Psychopaths and sociopaths feel very, very little remorse. Otherwise, they're quite similar. Lack of empathy, entitlement, grandiosity, that sort of thing.
Dr. Ramani Dhruvasula is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice in Santa Monica and Sherman Oaks, California. She is a professor of psychology at California State University at Los Angeles. She earned her bachelor's in psychology from the University of Connecticut and her master's degree and her PhD in clinical psychology from UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles. So you say every psychopath is a narcissist, but not every narcissist is a psychopath.
No, absolutely not. No. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness.
And so if someone is a narcissist, is that in and of itself a medical condition?
No, it's not. And that's a big, big misunderstanding people have. People say, hey, don't call me a narcissist. You can't diagnose me. And to say quite simply, you're not being diagnosed. Narcissism is a descriptive term. It's really describing a pattern, maybe a personality style. It's no different than calling someone stubborn or agreeable or conscientious. It's just a style. It's not a very nice style. And I don't think most people would view being called narcissistic as a compliment. But it is, in fact, commenting on a pattern. It's not a diagnosis.
How can we determine when we're looking at a narcissist?
A narcissist, I mean, it's kind of like it's one of those things. You feel it. They really lack empathy. They're deeply entitled. They think they're so deserving of special treatment. They're very grandiose. Big plans, often without a lot of action behind it. They're very superficial. They chronically seek validation. They tend to be very arrogant. They're very controlling. They're very superficial, very concerned about appearances, what a person has, where a person lives. They're very controlling, and they have a tendency to be manipulative and, in some extreme cases, even quite exploitative of other people.
Are they actually self-confident, or is it a mask for insecurity?
It's definitely a mask. And Stephen, that's a great point, is that a lot of people think narcissists are incredibly confident and well put together, but in fact, they're deeply, deeply insecure. I'd call them pathologically insecure. Listen, all of us have some level of insecurity. That's a normal part, sadly, of the human experience. But the narcissist insecurity is pathological, which almost makes it dangerous. Because when a person is that insecure, they tend to view the world as chronically threatening them. In the case of the narcissist, chronically threatening their fragile egos.
When you see a narcissist, is anger or temperament, is temper a part of narcissism?
Anger and temper are a huge part of narcissism. The interesting thing about a narcissist is they don't tend to show a lot of emotions or much vulnerability, but the one emotion they show in spades is anger. And I'd even call it rage, because it tends to be disproportionate to the stimulus. They tend to be very hypersensitive. And while they can dish it out to everyone, they cannot take it. And so they will just get ramped up really, really quickly. And it can actually be quite terrifying to be witness to it.
When we have something like narcissism that has behavioral definitions, and we see the behavior, is it a spectrum, or is there a black and white line by which we can say, okay, that person is a narcissist, and without this, they're not?
It absolutely, absolutely is a spectrum, just like anything, any kind of pattern we talk about, right? You can have a relatively benign pattern where the person is a bit of a jerk and a little full of themselves and kind of not aware of other people's feelings, but they're not really harmful. At best, they're annoying, and they're definitely not your go-to on a difficult day. It can, and then at the other end of the continuum is really malignant and toxic. They can feel willfully cruel. They're mean-spirited. They're manipulative and malevolent and exploitative. And in fact, I always say malignant or toxic narcissism is the last stop on the train before you get to psychopathy.
Come into the history and life of a narcissist.
Guilt and shame are key dynamics, actually, in understanding narcissism. The best way to think about guilt and shame is a very public emotion. It involves being judged by others and sort of having to take a wrongdoing or a bad behavior, if you will, and have it be judged in the public space and experience negative emotions. Whereas guilt is ownership that you did something bad, and that can be a very internal, individual kind of an experience. And again, that's really where the narcissists kind of break ranks with folks like psychopaths and sociopaths, because a narcissist will do bad things, but when they get found out, especially if they get found out and tried, if you will, in the court of public opinion, they'll feel very ashamed. And when people are full of shame, they actually behave badly again. It's sort of an interesting defensive maneuver. It's quite possible that that pattern has been there for that child since they were quite young, and then it developed into adulthood. But they do not do well with threats to their ego, and shame is a way that they manifest that. And sadly, they don't tend to learn from it. They actually tend to get more entrenched, more angry, and then they tend to do the bad thing again.
So narcissists probably don't apologize very often.
They apologize a lot because they do a lot of nasty stuff because they're trying to maintain the status quo, but they don't really mean it, right? An apology that's not accompanied by behavioral change is worthless. It's like a worthless currency. You know, I'd actually rather a person not apologize to me and change their behavior. That's what's more meaningful. But their apologies tend to be inane. They tend to be empty. They tend to be issued by publicists or lawyers or people working on their behalf. And in fact, many times when the narcissist issues an apology, it's kind of nonsensical, because instead of saying, I'm sorry for what I did, they'll say, I'm sorry you feel that way.
Is there such a thing as narcissistic personality disorder? And how is that distinguished from what you and I are discussing?
Yes, there absolutely is something called narcissistic personality disorder, and it's a diagnosis in the diagnostic manual we use in psychology and psychiatry. It looks a lot like this pattern called narcissism, but the thing that makes it jump the rails is that the person who is experiencing narcissistic personality disorder is either having a lot of impairment in their life, maybe their marriage is falling apart, maybe they're having problems at work, or they feel subjectively uncomfortable or distressed by this pattern of behavior. Estimates of the rates of narcissistic personality disorder as laid out in the research range somewhere between 1 and 7%, depends on who's doing the research. It's more prevalent in men than women. The problem is a lot of people who are narcissistic don't think they're having a problem, and their lives are going just fine. They're making tons of money. They got a wife. They got a mistress. They got a this. They got a that. They're on top of the world. So as long as they're on top of the world and nothing's going wrong for them, we don't diagnose it as narcissistic personality disorder. In fact, Dr. Alan Francis, who was one of the people who crafted the diagnosis many, many years ago, he's the one who's, don't give him a diagnosis. That's actually doing a disservice to people who have real mental illness.
We are talking with Dr. Ramani Durvasula. She is a psychologist. She's also an author. She's written a book called Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist. You can buy that book here now on the talkradio1.com website. And as you can hear, Dr. Durvasula, that's probably why you are generally called Dr. Ramani, right?
Ramani? Yes, Dr. Ramani. Yeah. So, in fact, some ways it was just sort of, it's just easier. It sort of flowed off people's tongues a lot easier.
Well, and Dr. Ramani,
I'll come to either.
Dr. Ramani, you've just become Dr. Ramani to me.
Perfect.
So you can find more about Dr. Ramani at Dr. doctor-ramani.com. So when we look at a psychopath, how do we know when we're looking at a psychopath?
I mean, the interesting thing about psychopaths is they can be incredibly charming at first blush. They're very glib, really well put together, articulate. There's something kind of chilling about them. It's almost too smooth. It's too successful. A great example of a psychopath is someone like Bernie Madoff. A lot of people will say he sort of charmed the pants off of them when they first met him. They really have that almost larger than life slick kind of feel. They also can be things like, you know, crime bosses or heads. You know, these aren't petty criminals. These are people who are really able to pull off some really serious, scary stuff. They tend to be very socially skilled.
So paid assassins, serial killers,
yeah.
Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, serial killers can fall. You know, serial killers do tend to be more psychopathic because, again, there's a lot of planfulness to being a serial killer, right? That it takes, you have to plan, you have to figure out how to not get caught, how to do another killing. But I think that more than anything, that with a psychopath, there's something chilling about them. Despite all of their patina of success, it's like looking into something quite hollow and soulless. And if you know what you're looking at or dealing with, you often feel almost like a chill in the room when a psychopath walks in.
For fans of Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Hannibal Lecter, psychopath?
Mm-hmm. Probably psychopath. You know, I mean, yeah, I would say psychopath, because what you'll see with Hannibal Lecter is he didn't tend to get enraged. That's more of the sociopath's territory. Sociopaths tend to have more hair-trigger tempers. They tend to get, they're like the guys who get into bar fights. You know, they tend to get much more angry. They're more sullen. They're more resentful. They're not as well put together. But the psychopath, smooth, glib, cool, cold. You know, there's a precise, almost surgical precision.
Dr. Lecter, surgical precision.
He's a surgeon. Yeah.
And calm. And so
yes.
When you say Bernie Madoff, let me ask you about a sociopath first, and I'll tell you why I thought
Madoff is a sociopath.
Yeah, so tell me what a sociopath is.
A sociopath tends to be not as well put together. They are they tend to be a little bit more socially clumsy. They are they still again have a lot of the similar characteristics of psychopath. They lack remorse. They can get into relationships, but they don't have that same sort of smooth, glib exterior. They don't tend to be as societally successful, if you will. They're not the ones who are running corporations and that kind of thing. And they tend to have tempers. The bar fight guys. These are the guys who, the domestic violence guys. These are the guys whose tempers just flare up quickly. They're also very sullen, very resentful, very angry at the world. There's this real sense that the world owes them something. And they're just brooding and resentful is what kind of comes to mind.
So, if we have a spouse beater, domestic violence situation is probably a sociopath because it involves out of control bursts of temper.
Probably could be a narcissist. It could be a narcissist. Like I said, since all sociopaths are narcissistic, it's almost like the one is included in the other. That's not to say, obviously, a psychopath would definitely be more than willing, especially to beat up a spouse, and because behind closed doors they can be quite cruel, horrifying people. But on the face of it, especially if they need something from you or they're trying to make a deal with you, very smooth, very slick, very suave. So psychopaths can show anger. They can, especially if someone is at all getting in the way of the thing they value most. And for psychopaths, that's power. So if anything impedes their ability to acquire power, whether that's through money, domination, violence, whatever, then they will get angry.
Are these various people born this way?
You know, that's a real debate in the literature. I would argue for the psychopaths, yes. The research on psychopathy is pretty compelling in terms of the fact that there are very clearly brain areas involved. Their brains are different. We do see some form of genetic association. So for the three patterns, psychopathy, sociopathy, and narcissism, by far, it's psychopathy that shows the most compelling evidence that it's likely inborn. And in fact, when we look at psychopathy, we do tend to see that it's a lifelong pattern, that as children, these were kids who were truant or might have been stealing, might have been bullying other kids, assaulting other kids, torturing animals, setting fires. These were tough.
If a psychopath is smooth and sophisticated and suave, how do we, as we move through life, figure out whether the people we're meeting in social circumstances, business circumstances, or who are running for office, how do we tell whether they're psychopaths?
You know, I'd look for someone who's a little self-effacing and is able to engage in critical thinking, take some ownership, and see themselves as a complex, nuanced creature. It's not all good. It's not all bad. It's not black and white. A person who just shows some level of self-awareness. That's one thing psychopaths, sociopaths, and narcissists are not. They are not self-aware. This is going to sound like a strange thing to say, Stephen, but I tell people when I meet people who are charming and charismatic, I actually find it quite terrifying. And I tend to step away from the conversation because doing what I do and seeing what those traits are often equated with, I'm sure more than a few times I maybe have missed out on a nice person who was probably charming and charismatic and nice, but I wasn't willing to take the bet. They play a very strong superficial front game. And I'd actually rather look at someone who's a little bit rumpled and maybe a little bit late and might have a little bit of dip on their lip kind of thing. You know, it's that. That's the person who is more self-aware, who's able to be self-critical, who actually is interested in listening to you. Sometimes charming and charismatic people really monopolize the conversation. It's all them and it's what they're doing in their company. And when it comes time for you to share about you, interestingly, they see an old friend at the bar and they walk away.
So humility is not something we're going to find in any three of these categories?
No. The reason there's no humility is because there's no self-awareness, right? A self-aware person is typically humble because we all recognize that we have strengths and we have faults or vulnerabilities. And that lack of self-awareness is a common driver in all three patterns. So no, and in fact, the humility feels like a threat to them, right? Then if they feel like they share their humility and perhaps their vulnerability, then people are going to be on to them, particularly for the narcissists, because their egos are so fragile. I think for the psychopaths and sociopaths, they view vulnerability as true weakness, and so they won't even go there.
How does a person being a psychopath fit into our legal system?
Oh, I mean, I hate to say this, and I don't want to disrespect your field, but many psychopaths often make great attorneys because they're willing to go for the jugular, and they don't care. I've seen this happen in divorce cases where I've seen psychopathic lawyers go in and kids who would have been much better off with having custody with one of the parents or shared custody, the psychopathic lawyer goes in and there's a real lack of remorse. And I honestly don't know how some of these folks sleep at night. So I think if you're in a very competitive legal setting as an attorney, psychopathy would serve you quite well. I mean, it's scary, but it's true.
So if a person is a psychopath and they don't have guilt and they don't have shame, but they're not criminal, they are suave and sophisticated and smooth, and they're very successful, can they be good people or are they doomed to ultimately act in a way that is really wrong?
Depends on what your definition of a good person is. I mean, I think that that's where things get a little tricky. We get into a semantic dark corner.
Well, let me define it. Good person is someone who consistently throughout their lives does good deeds, does really no horrible, horrible deeds, but most of their deeds are very good or good.
Okay, so then what happens is it's the measurement of becomes the deed and not always the intention,
yes.
Right? So if a person gives $10 million to a charitable organization, that's a good deed. But if that same person has made all that money by driving their employees to the point of stress and depression and not paying them properly and abusing them, the money, $10 million of those dollars went to a good place, but they're abusing people on a daily basis. So I think that's where this whole thing gets a little bit difficult, is that it all depends on who's looking at that psychopath. The charitable organization probably thinks the psychopath's a great guy. The person who's working in that psychopath's organization probably thinks they're a psychopath. So they wear many faces. And I think it really comes down to what side of them you're on. I personally believe that it's not even as much about deed as it is about also how the process of living. Are they able to be kind to other people and share compassion? Are they able to be there reciprocally and emotionally for other people? Are they able to show respect to a wide range of people and be able to hear a wide range of opinions? Are they able to engage in reciprocal, loving relationships? That's how I measure a good person. And by that definition, no way is a psychopath ever going to get there. Yeah, psychopaths have actually given major donations to major organizations that have gone on to do good things. I'd never want to work for one, though.
because typically their money is going to have been taken by intimidation and unfair practices.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, it really is that sense of, if you follow the money back, like, where did, you know, it becomes a really interesting sort of moral slippery slope. I think it's something that a lot of people struggle with too. You know, again, it really depends on what angle the light is hitting that person and how you're interacting with them, on how you think about them, whether or not they're psychopathic. But again, it really depends on how you're measuring the person.
It looks to me that to be a successful politician at a high level, that you need to be, at least in your professional life, virtually invulnerable to barbs and arrows as they come in. You have to be really insensitive to insult to be successful and effective. Is it a good idea for a politician to be a psychopath?
I don't think it's a good idea. No, I think that imperviousness you talk about to insult and all of that, that's definitely where a psychopath is quite strong, because they have low levels of anxiety. Things don't upset them the same way. They're actually very stress-free people because nothing bothers them, right? So yeah, I suppose that they're organized well to be in a world where people criticize them constantly and it doesn't bother them. But the reason it doesn't bother them is because they don't care. And the fact that they don't care means that they also don't care about the vast majority of their constituency. So no, I don't think it's a good thing. I understand that the system has made it, though, that those are the folks that are going to end up taking these positions. But I don't know that that's good for us as a citizenry.
You pointed out lawyers. I pointed out politicians. As we're talking, it begins to occur to me that frequently, highly effective people, particularly in competitive situations, show business or in a number of different walks of life, might have characteristics of a psychopath. Is this something that's very widespread?
Absolutely. In fact, there was some research I read recently where the estimate of the prevalence of psychopathy in company leaders, like corporate leaders, is somewhere between 6% and 21%. So by some estimates, 1 in 5 corporate heads is a psychopath. You know, you better believe it's the system is rigged that way. And I think a lot of that happened when we became more global corporations and there were just a few players, you know, and one huge organization overseeing lots of others, where human beings became more expendable and profits became everything. That when that became how business was being run, absolutely, then it became a psychopath's ground game. There's no way anyone else could compete. I'll be honest with you. If you just took all the most classical writings on psychopathy and gave them to business students, said, listen, read this and follow it chapter and verse, they would be more likely to succeed in business. But I don't think you can fake psychopathy. You know, I really don't. I think that I've actually worked with more than a few clients who really did. They tried to be psychopaths and they just couldn't get there. And they ended up leaving the C-suite. They ended up leaving high-level legal positions, going into the NGO world, going into their own entrepreneurial ventures. And they said, I wasn't made for that. And it was actually starting to kill my soul like a cancer. So, I mean, if you ain't made for it, you ain't made for it.
Would you go so far as to say that someone who is in politics at a high level or who is in high combat law? There are lots of things.
Yeah.
Some lawyers draft wills and trusts, so not all of it is high combat, but
right,
the sort of lawyer you see in movies or on television, would you say that if mostly you actually end up needing some of these characteristics, at least the narcissism, if not the psychosis, if not being a psychopath, to be successful and effective in swimming with sharks?
I definitely think it increases the probability you're going to succeed quite a bit. I think it would be hard otherwise. And actually, where I think it would become difficult, Stephen, is that you can try to go ahead and put on your gloves during the day and go and climb into the cage and fight the fight. But if it's not who you are, it's really going to wear you down. And so your shelf life for that is going to be pretty limited. But for people for whom narcissism and psychopathy comes naturally, that kind of high combat law is perfect for them. They like a fight. In fact, people who are narcissistic and psychopathic, they really do have a natural need or drive for power, and they welcome an argument. They live and die to win an argument. And that's why they don't make necessarily very good partners, because they always just want to argue and they want to win. And they don't take a moment to step back and just have empathy for their partner. Say, this isn't about winning. This is about supporting that other person right now.
Some of the at least three lawyers that I know pretty well say in essence that they put on their armor to go to work,
yeah,
and then they try to take off their armor when they come home. What are the chances that someone can successfully put on armor or take off armor if they are or are not a psychopath?
If a person is a psychopath, they cannot take that armor off and on. They can fake it. They can be sweet when they need to be sweet for a minute, but it doesn't really go deep, kind of thing. I mean, there's a sort of like they're missing the intimacy chip and they're missing the empathy chip. So they just can't really go there. Now, I do think that some people can compartmentalize to some degree, go in, be the eviscerating attorney by day and the loving spouse and parent by night. You know, given that the more ingrained these traits are, the more likely you're able to organically call upon them in the courtroom or in a deposition or wherever, compartmentalizing isn't good for us, right? It's like you're walling off pieces of yourself. And men are better at that than women, frankly, but I don't think it's for everyone. And so I think over time it causes wear and tear for the people this doesn't come naturally to. And I think some of that armor starts to stick to you. So even at home, you remain that person and it takes a toll on those folks.
I'm going to use different words to describe this, and I'll tell you now I'm describing who I think I am, and You tell me how realistic I'm being, and well, I guess whether I'm a psychopath. When I go into a negotiation scenario, I don't feel like I'm putting on armor. I feel like I'm playing a game, and I know what the rules of the game are, and I know them well. I've been doing it for nearly 41 years, and so when I'm in a settlement meeting or a negotiation, I know exactly what I have to do to cause the other side to feel feelings so that they will recognize the weaknesses on their side, so they will recognize the strengths on my side, so I can achieve an excellent settlement for my client of a dispute. And to me, that's a game. It's not, for me, different than it would be if I were in a baseball game and trying to hit the ball, or if I'm the pitcher trying to pitch the ball in a way that it cannot be hit. And then when I finish that, when I'm not in that mode, I don't do that. To me, it's a bright line of what I will do in a negotiation with an opposing attorney versus what I'll do with a friend, a family member, a partner, my children. When my parents were here, my parents. It's a very different world with a very different set of rules. Now, some of the same skills of articulation or argument, if we're talking about politics or whatever it might be, the difference might be unrecognizable. Though I believe I'm always courteous. And so what am I doing? How do you interpret what I just told you?
You know, I think that you have then cultivated that. Here's the thing. I think that you likely have in you a skill set. And again, I'm not going to be cruel about it, but it's a little bit of psychopathic cruel skill set. Like I said, all good salesmen are moderately psychopathic, right? You're trying to sell something to someone. Odds are that they don't need at the highest price possible. So you're trying to separate a fool from their money. And that's not nice. It's not nice. And while you're in there on behalf of your client, there's someone else on the other side of that table who's going to lose out. So it is gamesmanship, and gamesmanship is best mastered by people who have, a touch of psychopathy. Does that make you a psychopath? No. We all have moments when we're narcissistic, where we do put our needs before someone else, where we may be entitled and say, no, I don't want to wait in line. You know, that doesn't characterize all of who we are. And you're saying this isn't all of who I am, that I can go into this, I can play it like a game. And I'd imagine, Stephen, after 40 years of doing this, there may still be some cases you're like, well, yeah, I did well for my client, but someone got really hurt by this. And I mean, I don't know if that bothers you or not. You might say that it's a game and I won the game and the game has rules. And, you know, good for me, like a child might be at the end of a board game, or there might be times when you're like, ah, that didn't feel good. Like this family is going to suffer for a long time because of the money I got in this settlement. You know, on the other side, the family on the other side kind of thing. So it really, I would almost say, like, are there uncomfortable moments and are you able to acknowledge them? It's like, yeah, no, that doesn't always feel good. Much like I might have to say to a client, I can't see you because you can't afford my fee, even though I know they desperately need to see someone like me. But if I keep giving it away for free, I can't pay my mortgage, right? It's a complex rationalization. And some of those nights I don't sleep well. I don't. I'm like, God, I wish I could be there for every client who needs my services, but I can't. But you have kids to take care of and that kind of thing. So I think that we get ourselves into these corners, and I think that you have a skill set you're able to draw upon, but then you are able to put it down and be a family man and be there for your parents and be there for your friends. There is a separation But and you have a trait that not everyone has. Not everyone's meant to be a litigator for that reason. There's people who drop out of the law. They're like, I can't do this. I don't like conflict.
So
and some people just don't have a penchant for that.
To answer your question, yes, there were times very early, and I'd say in the first year of my practice, where we had a negotiation and I cleaned someone out and I went home and thought, well, that wasn't very fair and it wasn't very good. I got my client the result they wanted. But what I've discovered very quickly is that it was as much a negotiation with my own client as it was with the other side. So I had to process what my client wanted and help them figure out who they wanted to be. And I very frequently have conversations with my own client outside the presence of the other side where I ask, so what would be fair here? Would you like to do what's fair? Do you want to do what's fair? And if you do, what does that look like to you? And we have a thorough conversation or conversations about that so that I don't end up in and again, I'm doing business in real estate. I'm not doing family law, divorce, child custody. I'm not doing any of that. It's all business and real estate. And so I end up most always with an outcome that leaves me feeling that justice was done, that there's probably a tilt toward my client, but that rarely does my client even want to clean the other side out. And
okay, that's great.
And when I have a client who is wrong, I'll spend my time helping them understand that they're wrong so they can take responsibility for it and carry the mop and clean up the mess.
So then you're, I mean, to me, that's not psychopathy. A psychopath's like, we're going to tear the other side's throat out no matter what. You know, with it's always a zero sum game. It's only about the win. You know, that's a very different conversation. And I do think there's plenty of room in the law and in litigation of any form for there to be circumspection. And maybe you will leave a few more dollars on the table because most people aren't mean. Most people aren't narcissistic and psychopathic. But unfortunately, the ones that are hold a lot of societal power. That's what the challenge is. It feels like it's an epidemic, not because it is, but because the people who make the most noise are. And so that makes the rest of us feel, because they run all the platforms, then that makes the rest of us feel like it's everywhere.
I would also say that a trial lawyer, someone who does trials, that is a win-lose situation. It does not end up being a settlement. If it's a trial, you end up with one side winning, generally, and the other side losing, generally, and it's usually fairly harsh in both sides. And there, you can't compromise. You can't hold back. You can't aim. You can't aim somewhere off of center. You have to aim to wipe the other side out in the hope that you can win at all.
Right. And that's where it gets slippery. I mean, I have to say a fair amount of my clinical practice is helping people deal with downright PTSD when they've gone through trials, when they're often trying to put charges against a narcissist or a psychopath, where that person has great representation. And the other side's lawyer just destroys them and they're left with no justice and literal PTSD. You can understand from my seat why I think lawyers can actually be really, really heartless individuals. And it doesn't feel about a game, like it's about a game anymore. It's about someone's life and someone's heart and someone's soul. And I'm literally trying to glue a vase back together. But it's a human being.
I've certainly met plenty of lawyers, especially in some in family law, where they take on their client's rage and devastate the other side unnecessary roughness.
And not only the unnecessary roughness, what it does is it destroys the children. And I think it's the ramifications there, because what I do is I see these people were going put to this as children, as adults. And it was the win, right? Because of the way custody payouts, because a lot of narcissists and psychopaths actually don't want custody of their kids. It's a power and control game. It's a way to punish the ex-partner. And it's a way, because of how child support payments are given out, of managing, like, of ensuring that they don't have to pay out as much money, because they really care so much, desperately about money. And so, you know, that breaks my heart to see that happen, because now the parent is, I'm sorry, now the child is stuck spending time with a parent who's relatively indifferent to them, is much more interested in their own needs, and really only bargained for the child to win, not to be a parent to
the
child.
Well, when elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled.
Always. Yes, yes.
So if psychopaths are more or less, it sounds like, born, and sociopaths are more or less made, am I okay on that?
Absolutely.
If that's the case, how do you make a sociopath, or more importantly, how do you avoid making a sociopath when you're a parent?
The way to make a sociopath is to raise them in an environment of invalidation, abuse, inconsistency, deeply dominating, authoritarian, cold parents, particularly fathers. If one or both parents are substance abusers and are sort of remote at times and just unavailable, those are all great prime kinds of fertile ground for how to create a sociopath. So the flip side then is, how do you not? You raise a child in a consistent, loving space. You listen to the child's emotional needs. You don't poo-poo their vulnerability. You support them. You play with them. You enjoy them. You validate them. You're a consistent part of their life. But unfortunately, we're coming off of generations of really domineering, you know, power-obsessed, cold, invalidating, especially fathers. Who are often very punitive, very cold, very remote, and really told their sons, don't you ever show emotion. No man in this house shows feelings. No man in this house cries. That's a recipe for a sociopath.
You mentioned two words repeatedly in what you just said, and one was loving and the other one was consistent. Those are mm-hmm. two of my four pillars of parenting that I think mm-hmm. are so critical, and so consistency and unconditional love, the yes. the love and acceptance are going to be a part of this. A third one of my four pillars is modeling.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep, absolutely.
So do we model for sociopaths?
We absolutely do. I mean, in a lot of ways, if a child grows up in a home where one parent is, or both parents are beating each other up, or they're witnessing violence, when they watch uncivil behavior between their parents or on behalf of their parents to the outside world, when they watch their parents belittle or humiliate other people or them as children, when they watch their parents use really belittling language, you know, in their marital interactions, when they see the parent lie, cheat, steal, kids do what they see. You can give them any message you want, but at the end of the day, kids do what they see. When they see a deeply entitled parent, for example, they'll take that message that, yeah, I should get special treatment too. And so it's that, and it's also for the kid who grows up in those sociopath fertile homes, if you will. They are also still, every kid wants their parents to love them. And they'll often be spending their entire childhoods trying to get the notice of their relatively unavailable, inconsistent parents. And that can create that brooding rage that ends up coming out of sociopathy when they become adults. They were just never able to turn their parents' heads long enough to get them to notice them, because basically their parents didn't care.
Now, I know you're a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, so yes. Let me, in that context, ask this question. A lot of what you're describing, or I would say virtually all of what you're describing, is behavior. Are there objective medical tests that can actually diagnose someone who is a psychopath or someone who is a sociopath?
There's a test that was developed by a researcher named Hare, and he developed something called the psychopathy checklist. And now there's a version called the psychopathy checklist revised. And it's a series of items you go through and you check the ones that are relevant to you, and it generates a score. And that score really highlights the probability that this person has consistent and problematic psychopathic traits. Hare's questionnaire has been used around the world with a variety of populations, ranging from incarcerated to military to law enforcement to even just community samples. So that checklist exists. Hare and his other contemporary, Cleckley, their research on psychopathy is very much views it as like a style versus the diagnostic scales that we use in our diagnostic manuals, which tend to be more focused on criminal behavior or violation of the rights of others. And so Cleckley and Hare will snag someone for being sexually sort of exploitative. Like, in other words, a guy who only wants to be with women to have sex with them, but has no interest in really loving them, you know, being kind to them. Or they'll look at superficial relationships or being really glib and smooth, whereas the diagnostic manuals and the diagnostic checklists don't look at it that way. So yes, those checklists exist, but they're definitely not made for the average layperson to just sort of sit there and check them off and say, yeah, it must be a psychopath. Like, they're typically used in research applications more than they're even used in clinical settings.
Is any of this treatable?
You know, my short answer to that is not really, no. When you look at the treatment literature, the stuff is so damn subtle that whatever kinds of little tweaks we can make might be somewhat noticeable to a clinician or on a research rating scale, but to the people who have to deal with that person, we really don't see significant changes. And narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, they're like rubber bands, right? You can do treatment and maybe pull them out You know, yeah, teach them a little bit of empathy, teach them to show up on time, teach them not to scream as much. But as soon as that person is under stress, that narcissist or the psychopath is under stress, that rubber band returns to its usual size and they're as rageful as always. They don't tolerate frustration well. And I've seen very few examples, other than case literature, a case here, a case there, of people who are able to make significant strides. What does become interesting is from time to time, you'll get a narcissist into therapy and you really get there. You get them to be a little bit more empathic and self-aware. And you know what they report? They say, you know what? I feel really empty because I'm not a nice guy. And now you showed me I'm not a nice guy. And I've had patients say to me, I resent you deeply for that because I was actually rather contentedly going through my superficial life. And now I realize I'm a jerk. And so needless to say, it's not a very nice moment in their life. They actually would have liked to remain blithely unaware. And so if anything, some of them say, you know what, I got no place getting into close relationships at this point. Because and that's actually a relatively compassionate gesture. You know, to say, like, I'm not ruining anyone else's life. You know, I might have someone I have sex with from time to time, but I'm really probably not the marrying kind. And maybe one day I'll find myself a nurse when I'm older and pay her and she'll take care of me. So it's, yeah, there's really, because you got to remember, Stephen, the way you see change in therapy, no matter what the issue is that person has to admit something's not quite right and commit to change. In the vast majority of cases, people who are narcissistic, sociopathic, or psychopathic either don't think anything's wrong or they don't want to commit to change. And their tendency is to blame the world for their problems rather than take ownership.
Well, and
themselves.
If they're successful and effective in what they're doing, why would mm-hmm. they? It's worked for
why
them
would they?
All their lives.
Yeah, and they're blaming everyone else. Like, oh, my wife is difficult because she's this, she's that, my kids are this, my coworker that. Always blaming other people without any self-reflection on, maybe I had something to do with this. And if we can't get to that place of self-reflection, there's just no way to create significant change. And in addition, these three groups, narcissists, psychopaths, sociopaths, they tend to be really relatively inattentive when people, including psychologists, talk to them about their emotional worlds. They're just not interested. They just can't go there.
Are there
sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. There are rare cases I've seen, like I said, where the needle has moved. So I don't want to discourage all listeners saying, well, I'm going to throw up my hands and not try. There may be people out there who say, you know what? I'm going to do the hard yards here. I'm going to put my head down and I'm going to try to become a better man or woman. I always applaud that commitment. And I think in the hands of a good, strong, solid, non-intimidatable therapist, you could get some progress. It's just very, very, very rare.
So it ends up that your practice is more in dealing with the people who are connected to sociopaths, psychopaths, and narcissists.
It's about 80-20, to be honest with you. Yeah, I'd still say 20% of the folks I work with have significant those patterns in proliferation.
Is there any medication that is at all effective?
What we do is when I work with a psychiatrist on helping a client, what we see is that it's more about symptom relief. There's no narcissism pill. There's no psychopathy shot. It's a person with narcissism who might be depressed. Like, for example, we know people with narcissism are more likely to have symptoms of depression, anxiety, substance use disorders, sometimes even PTSD. So what treatment can focus on is resolving other symptoms that person may be having, perhaps addressing addiction, addressing depressive symptoms, that kind of thing, like bringing the volume down on things that might be making them more uncomfortable, more frustrated, and more prone to rage. But then what ends up happening is you might have a narcissist who's an alcohol abuser or a cocaine addict. You clean them up, they come out of rehab. Now they're just narcissistic. And so they're just as difficult as ever, but at least they aren't getting loaded.
Is a psychopath psychotic? And if so, what does that mean?
A psychopath is not psychotic. A person who is psychotic has had a break from reality. And that can manifest through either hallucinations or delusions. They either hear things that aren't there, see things that aren't there, or even feel things that aren't there. So it's a departure from reality. No one else is having that perceptual experience. Or they're having delusions, which are irrational or completely inaccurate or unrealistic beliefs. So they believe things that are happening that are not happening. So we have to see that literal departure from true departure from reality. It's not, in the case of a psychotic person, it's not like they're making a complex rationalization. It's not a manipulation. They really are, they're broken off from reality. People are psychopathic. That's not the case at all. In fact, it's like psychopathy translates to disease of the soul. That's really that's when you take that word apart, that's what it means.
Are narcissists, psychopaths, and sociopaths more likely to be men than women?
Yes, absolutely much more likely to be men. Part of it probably has to do with socialization. Men and boys, and this is a huge problem in our society, are raised to really not talk about their emotions, to told to put a lid on them, and are told to hide their vulnerabilities. And those are a setup for being more narcissistic, psychopathic, or sociopathic, because they just don't have emotional vocabularies, and we let off a lot of steam that way. We definitely foster men to go into more competitive industries. Men are more likely to be raised in a way that they might get the more full frontal force of like a very authoritarian or even abusive father or parent, whereas a girl child may be more prone to potentially sexual abuse by a family member. A boy child can also be vulnerable to sexual abuse, but it's more likely to be physical abuse. And so you can see there's just different patterns that they're exposed to as a child, different societal expectations. So for a boy to be very soft, gentle, feeling, to want to go into a feminized field like teaching or social work or cake baking or something, they can actually set themselves up for a lot of mockery and familial rejection. All of those things are set up. I will say this, though. We are seeing a shift away from that, and we are seeing more and more women obviously showing traits of narcissism, and many times women in positions of tremendous power have narcissism at just the same levels as men do.
So
it's about the power.
As women have entered the workforce over the last 50 years, and as that has changed, do you think that that distinction is erasing? Are we making now more female sociopaths than we used to?
Yes, we are, but still not nearly the rate as because again, girls play from a more emotional space. Girls are allowed to show emotion. And so it would, again, and because that starts so young and it's so entrenched in sort of the girl's early life, that's not something that's likely to change anytime soon. Girls get more reinforced for using more emotional language. And so even as girls may try to enter more competitive industries, we do see, for example, there's really interesting literature on leadership that shows that women often make better collaborative leaders, where they're able to draw out the strengths of various team members and don't feel as threatened by the team members. You know, so it's that more and more corporations are like, oh, maybe we could really draw on the strengths of our employees if we have more female leadership. So they're built to be different kinds of leaders many times. But sadly, sometimes the ones who skyrocket to the top of the most competitive leadership are the women who got selected in because they were more narcissistic. They were willing to go for the jugular, which women tend not to be as socialized to do. Women tend to be a bit more conflict averse, and they tend to be more collaborative.
We talked about how not to make a sociopath and came up with, I think, three central tenets. One was to be consistent rather than unpredictable, to be loving unconditionally, and to model behavior, which is not sociopathic. So that's how not to make a sociopath. How do we not make a narcissist?
You know, it's very, very, very similar premises. I think, again, it's because, again, sociopathy is a more severe variant. What we see is that their early environments tend to be a bit more abusive and hostile and antagonistic. I'm actually surprised when I see the number of folks who are narcissistic who actually came from rather kind, loving homes. You know, there is actually not as much of a formula. Part of the challenge is that even in the most consistent, kind, loving homes, we're thrusting people into a world where validation is everything. How many followers do you have on Instagram? How many likes do you have on that photograph? You know, I want to be a YouTube star. I want to be a this, you know, so there's a big push on fame and fortune for everybody in all young people. So they're having to almost resist like a salmon swimming upstream, you know, falling into those. I want to make a lot of money. I want to be, oh, you know, I want to be, all these things are very superficial. Our schools aren't doing a good job of sort of developing kids' inner worlds. So focused is everyone on getting a kid into Harvard. They're not actually giving them the psychological skill sets they need to be a solid human being. And so it's almost conspiratorial, where even when the family's on point, they're still trying to fight a really tough battle against society. And so any parent will say, like, how much time they're battling, keeping their kids off of devices and screens and YouTube. And, you know, it's a tough battle. And so kids are getting different kinds of messages and different kinds of demands on them. A lot of kids are being sheltered from frustration. Parents sometimes who are thinking they're being very loving and like, I don't want my little kid to ever experience any frustration or disappointment. Then they go into adulthood and they don't know how to tolerate frustration and disappointment, which is a part of adulthood, and they can really act out and lash out. So it's about finding that sweet spot and saying, guess what? You're going to be uncomfortable. I don't care if you like it or not. So, you know, and figure it out, and you're not going to die. And I'm here and I love you no matter what, but you're going to have to learn to be frustrated. You don't always get a car on your 16th birthday.
Close to the beginning of November, Chris Watts in Colorado pled guilty to the killing of his pregnant wife and of his two daughters. The word psychopath popped into my mind. Now that I've spoken with you, it sounds like that's a correct description, because it looked like he did it for the purpose of simply getting them out of his way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, psychopaths and sociopaths, and to some degree narcissists, view other people as inconveniences. Either convenient when they need them, maybe to make money, to have sex, to make a deal, and then they'll put all their focus on them. But when they have no more need for them, it's almost like junk you want to give to the junkyard, or clothes you want to give to it, you know, to the trash. I mean, they really, when they're done with people, they're done. They view them as expendable objects. And so in these cases, where it would have been a lot more simple to just tell your wife, hey, listen, I want a divorce, and, you know, that might be uncomfortable or whatever it may be. No, I mean, they'll go there. They will kill someone and kill their own children. That's a psychopathic move.
And the reason would be, I imagine that if you asked him, why didn't you just divorce her? He would say, well, it would have been simpler. Would have been simpler if I'd gotten away with it to just kill all of them, because then I wouldn't have to subdivide my finances.
That's
I wouldn't
right.
have to have a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I'd get caught.
Well, they don't think they're going to get caught. And psychopaths, as a rule, do not think consequences through. In fact, some people implicate brain areas associated with impulsivity and decision making. Those tend to be haywire in people with psychopathy. So they will commit crimes of all levels, from petty crimes to the most heinous crimes. They don't even think through the consequences. They want what they want in a certain moment, and they'll do anything and won't let anything stop them from getting it. And so it's, again, if you look at the pictures of this guy you're talking about in Colorado, he was handsome and charming and all of that. I mean, I'm sure there were cracks under the surface in the marriage, but, you know, and people say, why do psychopaths have kids? I'm like, because kids make you look good, especially when they're cute and you have a Christmas card and everyone oohs and ahs over your Facebook posts over your kids. The kids become an accessory. They're not little people that they want to raise, but they just become an extension of themselves, and there's something to make them look good until they're inconvenient.
So when we hear of leaders of countries, of other countries, who have who kill their own people, or who kill agents that they consider to be enemies of their country, when they cause murders to occur, is that most likely strictly psychopathy mm-hmm. and psychopathic behavior?
Definitely. It's definitely. I mean, that idea of, you know, genocides are perpetrated and, you know, are the work of psychopaths, you know, and then in this idea that they could kill their own citizens really for their own gain. That's psychopathy.
When we see someone make an inconsistent statement that this is a great person and then this is a terrible person, and there hasn't been much of a change except the person speaking has been insulted or turned on, what is that, the narcissism, or does that go farther?
You know, it's that the sense of projection and projection of blame. Again, remember, all psychopaths are narcissistic. So many narcissists will do that, but it's also something psychopaths do too. I mean, but it's almost like they're Teflon in the face of responsibility and blame.
Let's go back to Bernie Madoff. Did you have the sense that he had regret? I didn't.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And that's why you put him in
no
the psychopath category.
In fact, when you look at Madoff's interviews, and I've studied Madoff's case chapter and verse because he was such a pristine example of a psychopath, it really was like he felt inconvenienced. And to him, it was a game. It was a game at could he get away with it? I think at some point there was just so much money, it was irrelevant. How many yachts did the man need, right? But it was the absolute disregard for people were killing themselves. These were pensioners. These were not all really rich people. And absolutely to this day, absolutely no remorse and no self-awareness that he has two dead sons and just the huge wake of damage behind him.
So what was Ruth Madoff thinking all those years? Was this invisible to her, or is this something, does she fit in a category of her own? Whether she knew about the business
dealings
or not.
There's a lot of denial. There's a lot of denial. People who are in relationships with narcissists or psychopaths, it's a real, it's a trick of the eye kind of thing. They are able to engage in a lot of denial, a lot of rationalizations. Lots of times life for the narcissist or a psychopath can be very financially comfortable. And so people are like, I like my house. I like my country club memberships. I like my fancy cars. How about we look the other way? And so they don't want to see what the sausage is made of. And they themselves also, on another vein, they themselves, sometimes their partners, I don't think this was the case of the Ruth Madoff, but they themselves have often been so abused that they have so much, they have such severe post-traumatic stress disorder that they just simply don't have the bandwidth or the resource to be able to step out of that relationship. So it can be everything from being very Machiavellian and very, you know, almost being thinking that they can outwit this, down to people who have just been so abused that they can't find the way out.
So you're saying that when I think about the guy in Colorado, Chris Watts, or when I think of Bernie Madoff, and when I do, as I think many people do when we see these stories in the news, we say, how could they possibly have thought they would get away with it? Your answer is they didn't.
They didn't. They didn't stop to think about it. They didn't even stop to think about it. And after you get away with it for a little while, it's very seductive to think you'll keep getting away with it. So it's a, you know, it's almost like the first time you steal something, like, oh, I shouldn't do that. Second time. And then the third time you're like, oh, this is really easy. It might be like you're stealing Post-its from the office. And so, you know, it's all relative, right? Like most of us don't feel guilty if we steal a bunch of Post-its from work.
So then when we hear that, when we hear in politics that people are denying things, and you say, don't they realize that the cover-up is really the problem, that if they take responsibility and admit fault, why do they always cover it up? Why don't they just come clean? The answer would be because they simply don't believe they'll be caught.
They don't think they'll be caught. And again, they're playing a legal game, right? Never admit guilt. Never admit guilt. You might get away with it. You know, I think, unfortunately, that's how our legal system is made. Our legal system is not designed to force people to take responsibility. It's designed for people to put a lot of Crisco on their bodies and see if they can slither out.
your description fits the Menendi, Lyle Menendez, yeah, and Eric Menendez, who I gather killed their parents to get the money, to get the parents, yeah, out of the way, because the parents were now trying to cut back on their funds. Simply psychopaths?
Yeah, simply psychopaths. That's it. I mean, you know, when it's really that sort of straight, cold killer for money. I mean, obviously, the defense was that they had been abused, et cetera, et cetera. The trial showed otherwise. But all of that said, it was just so calculated and precise. And this is what we're doing. That, yeah, very likely. Very likely. Yeah.
So can you apply this to help us understand the now practically weekly shootings, whether they're in a church, a synagogue, or from the a high floor in a Las Vegas hotel? Can you apply any of this to help us understand how that fits to this formula?
Absolutely. I mean, again, in these cases, I think a lot of these are committed by people who are more sociopathic, who are resentful and sullen and angry at the world and not that socially skilled. So in fact, this almost feels like a solution. That tends not to be as much the psychopath's handiwork as the sociopath's handiwork. You know, so that's where you see a lot, the synagogue shooting, the shooting in Las Vegas. Those guys felt much more sociopathic than psychopathic. And I'm going to say this sidebar, Stephen. I actually have to go in a minute because I had just down for an hour and I have a client that I have to go see.
I support that. Listen, I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Romney Dervasula, for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com. I very much appreciate it and I'd love to have you on again.
It's my pleasure. I hope we can do it again soon. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Dr. Romney Dervasula. She is, you can find out all about her at her website, doctor, that's doctor-romney, ramani.com. You can buy the book here now on the talkradio1.com website, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist. This is a very clear-thinking person, and I would say that if you have need for counseling or in the Southern California area, she'd be a good person to talk to. My next show will be 2 weeks from today. And because none of us are going to get out of here alive, I'm going to have Dr. Sam Harrington on. He's a medical doctor who's written a book called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Because all of us will face this at one level or another at one point or another. That's 2 weeks from now, Saturday, December the 15th, 2018, 10 o'clock a.m. Pacific, 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Remember to use our Amazon link and our eBay links when you shop Amazon or eBay from the TalkRadio1.com homepage. It costs you nothing extra and helps support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. There's another way you can do that by making a direct contribution using our PayPal link. You can make a one-time contribution or a monthly contribution, whichever suits your finances. TalkRadio1.com's goal is to keep the show streaming live and available as podcasts at no cost to you. To do that, we need your support, so throw a few bucks on to TalkRadio1.com. My email address, steve@TalkRadio1.com, steve@TalkRadioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spearer. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.